Easy Shoppen mit PayPal. Geht jetzt auch im Laden. Ob Späti oder Club, mit PayPal bezahlst du auch im Real Life einfach und sicher. Und in Restaurants und Bars gibt's sogar noch 5% Cashback, wenn du mit PayPal zahlst. Tipp dir mehr mit PayPal. Alle Infos auf paypal.de. 5% Cashback nur auf Einkäufe vor Ort in Restaurants und Bars in Deutschland bei kontaktloser Zahlung mit PayPal. Gültig vom 2. Juni bis 19. Juli 2026 für die ersten 850.000 berechtigten Kunden. Maximal 15 Euro Cashback pro Konto. Es gelten Bedingungen auf paypal.de.
Stu does America.
Do us a favor. Go to youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica and subscribe. If you hit the bell for notifications, you'll know whenever we go live or put up some new stuff that you're going to want to check out. Also, you can get Stu Does America merch at StuDoesMerch.com. Use the code Stu10, get 10% off your entire order now. Get Scott Linsicum with us today to tell us the latest on Donald Trump's tariff push. I'll check in on the Biden-era TikTok ban to see how that's going. Notice much difference, but we'll see. But we're going to start by doing EDS, Elon Derangement Syndrome. I think we got a new ED. Now, you might have several others, and I my apologies for that. There are medications that might be able to help you. But there's no medication to cure EDS, unfortunately. Elon Derangement Syndrome is real. It is. And people are fired up. A lot of people have it. And so many people have it now, they're just like attacking his companies straight out. In fact, today there still is a massive cyber attack against X/Twitter. We get attacked every day, but this was done with a lot of resources. Either a large coordinated group and or a country is involved, and they are currently tracing it. That is a tweet from Elon Musk. I guess it's technically an X, right? From Elon Musk. But he's talking about, because, I mean, if you wanted to go on there and find out what was going on, for example, on NFL free agency kickoff day, and all of a sudden, all the freaking NFL reporters' Twitters aren't working. That's the type of terrorist attack that should start a world war. It's a very important day for X and Twitter. And they screwed it up. So I'm very angry about that. But it's not just Twitter with Elon. Elon Derangement Syndrome is going far, far beyond that. Tesla shares are plunging as Musk's political role grows more divisive. And, you know, I like charts. You get a little version of the chart there, but let me give you a bigger version of it. What's interesting about it is you see Election Day, Tesla stock was, I don't know, 250, went all the way up to almost 500 and is now back to basically 250. So we've seen a major run up and a major run down when it comes to Tesla shares. Now, you might say, wait a minute. Does that really have to do with the political aspirations of Elon Musk? Partially, although there could be other reasons. For example, you know, the Cybertruck, not my favorite Elon play. The Cybertruck design disaster is complete as Tesla gets desperate. This story is basically about how there are, you know, all sorts of incentives going into the Cybertruck. They can't get them off of the lots. And look, it's a pretty specialty vehicle, right? Like, I think it's the worst looking thing I've ever seen in my entire life. I can't stand it. I think it's bizarre. You might love it. I think people who love it really, really love it. And it certainly has amazing technology inside of it. I mean, you know, you can, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a Tesla nerd, and he's like, you can power your entire house. You can just plug this into your house and actually power your entire house. Like, it's a battery, like a generator for a time if your power goes out. I mean, it really is an amazing piece of equipment. That being said, it's hideous. Let's be honest about it. It looks like a kid designed it because kid did design it. That's pretty much where I am on the Cybertruck. And, you know, you might love yours. You might want to get one. You might like everyone staring at you everywhere you go. It's not always a stare like, you know, when a Lamborghini passes you by, people are like, whoa. Not exactly that with the Cybertruck, in my opinion. But that being said, Tesla has done a lot of really good things. They're one of the most powerful car companies in the world, which is quite a statement. I mean, they really have completely changed the way we drive. And now there's just hatred for Elon Musk. Six protesters arrested at the NYC Tesla showroom. Let me show you some of the footage of this. This is you see people kind of just coming in, and there's tons of protesters outside. They're saying they want to boycott. They're kind of just like rushing. Like, remember the old flash mob thing? They're like flash mobbing into Tesla dealerships and vandalizing them. They've got signs with Elon Musk doing a Nazi salute, which, of course, obviously he wasn't doing. Doesn't make any sense at all to believe that he was doing it. But of course, when did making sense have anything to do with this? Right. That's not the purpose of what we're doing here today together. Now, another fascinating development about this, and I think this is the one that hits me most centrally, I will say, because I, you know, I love the environment stories. I love the hypocrisy of the environmental movement. It just brings me joy. And now we're into a situation where people who preach to you about how you should buy Teslas for years and years and years and years are now embarrassed because they have Teslas. It's true. This is the New York Times. Tesla for sale. Buyer's remorse sinks in for Elon Musk's EV-owning critics. The buyer's remorse is playing out at a volatile moment for Tesla as stocks dropped by double digits in the last week, wiping out most post-election surge for Mr. Musk's company. A recent report showed plummeting sales in Europe, and the company faces increased competition from other EV makers as it's eating away at its market share. Recent protests outside Tesla showrooms in the United States are some notable cases of vehicle owners being harassed have also made headlines. With its futuristic curves and eco-friendly mantra, Tesla in the past decade has gone from curiosity to celebrity status to ubiquity. 2015, the company said it sold 50,000 cars globally. 2019, that number had jumped to 367,500 vehicles, and in 2021, it was nearly a million. To tell you how long this thing's been around, I remember doing a segment. We did a global warming special back on CNN Headline News, which I think is maybe still a network. I'm not 100% sure if it's still on. I think it is. But we were on it. It wasn't as widely watched as some of the other work we've done, but I think we did some good stuff there. And we did a global warming special. One of the segments was with, I think it was the first CEO, the first founder of Tesla. And this is back in, we went over to Fox in 2009. So it had to be 2008 or 2007 in that general vicinity. So that's how long they've been around. I mean, the original Tesla Roadster came out. And the point of that segment was to say, hey, I'm not really interested in an electric car, but if you're going to make electric cars work, you got to do it kind of like this new company is doing it, where they're taking their car, they made a $100,000 car that's really, really fast and really cool looking. And it's not for everybody, but it can get people started down that road. Maybe they make some gains there with the evil rich people, and they're able to turn that into a larger business. Well, that kind of happened. It did. It worked out pretty much exactly like the hopes were for that segment. And maybe if electric cars are going to be the future of our country, at least they won't suck so badly. After that, Elon Musk, who was an investor early in Tesla, but not the guy who actually founded it, but he wound up, of course, shepherding it into the massive thing that it is today. And so, this has been a long run. And it was something that was not only utilized, certainly in our case, of just saying, hey, technology can be cool, and if electric cars are great, we'll embrace them. I've got nothing against them if they work great. The left has always been pushing it because it is such a central part of their ideology to oppose global warming. Let me give you a little bit more from this article. More recent years, Mr. Musk has been more widely known. He has drawn criticism for his sweeping cuts to federal agencies as part of the Trump administration and his support of the far-right AfD party in Germany and his views on COVID lockdowns. No one's following Elon Musk his support of the AfD party in Germany. Give me a break. We all know what it is. It's all about Trump and the ties to the administration. That's what it's about. He likes him. So that's the big problem. Now, it did start with COVID. He opened up his factory before the people in California wanted him to, because he wanted to make cars that were supposed to save the environment from our greatest existential threat. But apparently that wasn't okay at that point. I don't know. Tesla sales were resilient, climbed each year no matter what really happened, climbed along what market researchers describe as a loyalty among their customers. Most recently, monthly sales have seesawed between 50,000 and 60,000 after years of explosive growth. In 2024, Tesla reported the first annual sales drop in its history. And you can kind of understand this, right? Obviously, Elon Musk is somebody that you probably appreciate right now, mostly. Maybe not all of his views. Certainly, I don't agree with him on a lot of his global warming stuff. But generally speaking, this approach to Doge is something I at least have high hopes for. We will see where it lands. There's a lot of bureaucracy in his way, and whether he'll succeed in all these cuts, we don't know. But I at least like the approach, at least the attempt to go in there and make our government more efficient and slimmer. And you can see how if the car is associated with that, if you're on the left, it's the last thing in the world you want, right? You've got Hitler in office, and you're like, am I really going to buy the Himmler car company? That's how they look at these people. The second you disagree with them on something, you turn into a Nazi, and we can give you whatever name of a Nazi that you'd like. But the bottom line is, it's hard probably on the left, right? Like, you're trying to have all your cool lefty friends, your cool environmentalist friends. Do they praise you for having an electric car? Do they shun you for being associated with somebody who seems to not think Donald Trump is Hitler? Very, very difficult conundrum for a lot of these people. As I mentioned, shares of Tesla dropped 13% during the last week of February. Market value now under $1 trillion, which kind of seems like almost like comedy, like $1 trillion used to be like a fake number. The shares closed at $284.65. They are down 40% from December 17th. In the United States, perhaps the most notable rebuke of the car brand was lodged by Sheryl Crow. There's a name you haven't heard in a while. Singer-songwriter posted an Instagram video in February showing her waving goodbye as her electric vehicle was driven away in a flatbed bed truck. The actress Octavia Spencer and the musician Casey Musgraves were among the celebrities who commented on messages in support of the decision. I remember AOC kind of going through the same thing. She bought a Tesla, and she was upset that she had a Tesla because Elon Musk was now evil. And I guess his being rich and wanting to cut the government down to size is a bigger issue than the globe catching on fire. So you can totally keep track of that logic, I'm sure. It's possible. This is not just people, though, abandoning their cars. Graffiti and middle fingers. Tesla Cybertrucks have become a political statement. One of the issues here when you go through this particular story is you see an issue that can actually be real for your average Tesla driver, right? Like, especially if you're in a blue state, you know, you may have tried to do this for the environment. You may have just kind of bought one because it's fast and cool. No matter why you bought one, if you're getting harassed everywhere you go and people are throwing things at your car, there was a parade this weekend in New Orleans where people were pelting Cybertrucks in the parade with beads and beer cans. Like, you know, your stuff's getting damaged. Like, most people aren't this ideological, right? Like, they don't live in this weird world that people live in on Twitter, and they just don't see the world like that. They say, oh, that's just another car passing me by. I don't have to attack it because I don't like the guy who owns the company. Like, it's hard to even, I don't even understand it, frankly. One of the things that I love about capitalism, and I know the left doesn't love capitalism all that much, but one of the things I love about it is I don't have to screen every individual I do business with on all of their opinions, right? Like, we engage in trade that benefits both of us. If you, like, they want to sell a car, you want to buy a car, you think you're addressing global warming, he thinks you're addressing global warming. Who cares if you are addressing global warming? That's a totally different situation. But at the end of the day, you're both doing something that you think benefits you, right? Selling the car benefits Elon, buying the car benefits you. That's capitalism. You don't have to screen every single one of their opinions. If I were to buy a Tesla, which I get honestly closer and closer to just because of how badly Elon Musk gets treated by the media these days. But if I were to buy a Tesla, like, I wouldn't necessarily be buying it because I certainly wouldn't be buying it because I agree with Elon Musk's opinions on global warming or space travel or having, 14 kids with God knows how many mothers. Like, those aren't my policies. Those are his policies. But I'm an adult. I realize that the car doesn't bring along his ideas, right? Like, the car is a car. That's it. I don't all of a sudden, start trying to expand the global population by hooking up with a bunch of people because I have a Tesla. That's not how that works. You're still you. You're just driving at a car that you might enjoy. They're vandalizing Cybertrucks. Here's one with a swastika on it because there's nothing more Nazi than electric trucks. Also, MSNBC is gleeful. As they go, they are now abandoning, they tell Musk to abandon Doge while gleefully reacting to a SpaceX explosion. Here is MSNBC anchors along with Michael Steele talking about this, and listen to the glee.
It is the second consecutive Starship test flight from Elon Musk's company to end with destruction. All I could think about was, I can't sing.
No, please don't. That's good. That's good. We got it. We understand.
That was funny.
How painful that was for y'all out there. Just as watching things blow up. His response to all of this was, rockets are hard. And Mr. Musk, if they're so hard, why don't you go back to your day job? and work that out.
Do you get it? Like, that was funny because they, I can't trace why it was funny, but in theory it was funny. Try to figure that out. I will say that's the new show, by the way, they replaced Joy Reid with. So if you're thinking like, oh, Joy Reid, they finally got rid of her. Maybe they'll get somebody sensible. No, they got three times the nuts is what they got. That's that. That was the decision made by MSNBC. No big renovation going on over there. Look, aside from the nonsense that you see on TV, there is a central disconnect here when it comes to the media. And what they tell you is science. How often did we hear science is king? Listen to the science. Well, the science, if you listen to their science, quite clearly would tell you electric cars are a net positive. Electric cars are going to save the world from global warming. They're going to get rid of the 20% of our emissions that come from our transportation sector. They're going to change the way that we move and all these incredible things. And then the second the person who's advanced that cause more than any single individual in the history of the planet disagrees with one of their policies, he's Adolf Hitler. It's almost like they don't mean anything that they say. And I know that sounds like I'm really going out on a limb, but it's almost as if none of these things are actual beliefs. It's almost like, almost, it's so, so close to them not actually caring about global warming at all. Maybe, just maybe, they're using global warming to get themselves a little bit more power and to hang on to whatever power that they have. That seems to be the real focus, because if you can implement global warming policy at the levels that they want it, for example, not the way that Elon Musk has approached it, where he's created his own vehicles and tried to solve it that way, along with, by the way, a giant solar panel company and a space exploration company, which, by the way, the one they were laughing at, was partially designed to remove humans from Earth, bring them to Mars to avoid global warming. That's how serious Elon Musk is about it. Now, I'm sure Michael Steele has done something almost as strong to stop global warming as Elon Musk has. But the second they disagree with one of those policies, all of a sudden, the greatest existential threat we've ever faced, the thing that has to be an overarching policy to control your energy consumption, your travel, everything that you buy, everything that's manufactured, even the location from which your food is derived, all of that comes crumbling down because he voted for the wrong guy once. Once. In fact, he didn't even endorse him until one of their donors almost killed the man. And still, he's the enemy of all enemies. It is, to say it gently, the most pathetic display, because we had to sit through 20 years of them saying this was going to kill us, and we have to get electric cars to save us. And the second that electric cars and solar panels and space exploration comes out of the mind of one guy, they bail on him instantly because he won't check every single one of their other ridiculous boxes. It is maybe the most revealing thing we've seen from the left in quite a long time. And you know, look, they expose themselves daily, so that is really saying something. But when you think about how central this has been to their entire worldview for so long, the fact that they've abandoned it this quickly is stunning, but also at the same time, and these two things can exist, it could be stunning and it could be the most obvious and expected thing that you can ever imagine, because that is who these people are. Buying or selling a home right now is probably like it's just insane, right? Like, it's like trying to play chess while blindfolded and on fire. Like, very difficult. You've got the sky-high mortgage rates. You've got the housing shortage that is going on. The market's a mess and can be at times. You need someone smart to help you walk through it. I mean, if homeowners a lot of times don't even want to sell, what do you do? If buyers are scrambling to get the last few listings out there and just, populating a market that's very strange right now, It all can kind of feel like a rigged game. And that's exactly why you need a real estate agent who knows how to win. Not some weekend warrior who sells a couple houses a year. Those people are fine. They're doing their best. But when it's your home, when you're figuring out where to buy or sell, you want an actual pro who is understanding the market, who is knowing the right strategies, who is getting you the best deal possible. And that's where Real Estate Agents I Trust comes in to connect you with the best agents in your area, top performers who know how to navigate this insanity and come out on top. So whether you're buying or selling or both, these agents have the expertise and the track record to make sure you don't get crushed in the process. Don't go into this market blind. Get the best agent on your side today at realestateagentsitrust.com. The name says it all. It's realestateagentsitrust.com, a free service for you. It's realestateagentsitrust.com.
Kaffee in seiner besten Form. Mit Cubo wird jeder Kaffee auf Knopfdruck zum Genussmoment. Denn mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Chibo genießt du feinsten Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Vollmundige Aromen dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie und über 17 Sorten Kaffee für jeden Geschmack. Erlebe Premium-Kaffee schon ab 29 Euro. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo-Kapselmaschinen in deiner Chibo-Filiale und auf chibo.de.
I'm happy to welcome Scott Linsicum back to the program. He's the VP of General Economics at Cato's Stifel Trade Policy Center. Scott, thanks so much for coming back on the program, man. I appreciate it.
Good to be back.
Yeah. Let's go through some of the tariff stuff that's going on right now, because, you know, it is, I think it's somewhat of an emotional topic for a lot of people. You know, it kind of hits them where they live, especially in certain areas of the country. I thought maybe we could go through some of the history of tariffs and how they've actually worked or not worked all that much. Let's start with the previous Trump administration, where he used washing machine tariffs were one that were put on there that he put on in the first administration. And the argument here, I think, connects with a lot of people, right? Like, manufacturing, these things used to be manufactured here, that all this manufacturing has moved somewhere else. We want to get those jobs back here. The motivation is understandable, but how do they actually work out?
Well, they tend to not work very well. And you look at the washing machine tariffs, and there's, I think, 3 points we need to remember. First is that there was a substantial increase in the price of washing machines. So you saw about 10 to 15% increase in those prices and a complementary increase in dryers that weren't even covered by the tariffs. But since they're typically sold and purchased together, both prices went up. So that's hard for consumers, most of whom don't work in manufacturing or in washing machine production. The second big issue is that these tariffs did boost some jobs. We saw some new investment in South Carolina by Samsung and LG to make washing machines. But you're talking just a handful of jobs, around 1,000 jobs here, at an immense cost. So we mentioned all those higher. You're talking about around $900,000 per job per year that consumers paid to support these jobs. And then the third big issue, though, is they didn't lead to some sort of wholesale renaissance in the industry or in manufacturing. First, the jobs were in a different place than the jobs lost to imports. Those were in Ohio at Whirlpool. The jobs gained were in South Carolina. So it's totally different jobs. But beyond that, the tariffs, when they went away, which they did in 2023, actually you saw imports immediately return. So you didn't actually get this wholesale boost and to a thriving domestic washing machine industry. Instead, it was just this kind of temporary sugar high that cost us a lot of money.
So it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Scott, that's kind of the story of most of these examples, right? Like, you can maybe get some jobs out of it back to your country, but it's usually at a cost that is massive. Like, obviously, like, for these jobs, we could have just paid them, you know, $800,000 a year, and they would have probably been happier with that outcome.
Yeah, and there's plenty of free market reforms that we could undertake, tax policy, trade policy, immigration policy, regulatory policy. There's tons of things that we can do to boost manufacturing. And some things that the Trump administration did when they were imposing those washing machine tariffs, they're also imposing good tax policy with respect to corporate taxes and in taxation of investment. Those are the types of things we should be focusing on because, first of all, they're far less costly to the economy, and they're far more effective. When you lower the corporate tax rate, you're not just benefiting the washing machine industry or 1,000 people in South Carolina. You're benefiting the entire economy. You're benefiting the entire manufacturing sector, and you're keeping politics out of it, which, let's face it, there's this long history with U.S. tariff policy of there being a lot of cronyism and corruption that's tied to this because everybody just runs to Washington and they want their own tariffs or their tariff exemptions. And these kind of flat policies like corporate tax policy, that kind of avoids a lot of those political problems too.
Yeah. Let's go a little bit deeper on that, because part of the reason why it seems to me that there's such a high cost for each job when you attempt this approach is that companies even overseas get really good at avoiding these tariffs. Like they're it's such a complicated process, so difficult to actually enforce, and companies get pretty nimble overseas as well. How does all that work?
Yeah, so, you know, there are people whose livelihoods depend on finding a penny of savings in supply chains. And so when you impose tariffs, particularly on just one country, well, the supply chain adjusts. And, you know, going back to washing machines or at looking at solar panels and other things, you see that U.S. tariffs start with, say, China or Japan. And then when investment shifts, then you have to go chase to Vietnam, and then you need tariffs on Southeast Asia or India. And so it's like a game of whack-a-mole, and with the costs increasing every time you swing that hammer. And so that's a really difficult thing to get beyond unless you have these big global tariffs. Now, that can effectively eliminate all that country hopping, but that comes at a massive cost because you're really creating kind of a domestic monopoly for American manufacturers. You're letting them jack up their prices because they don't have any other competition. And so, you know, you can somehow solve that supply chain problem, but it's going to really cost you.
Scott, one argument I hear often from people who are more friendly to tariffs than I am is that this is kind of how we used to do it, right? Like back in the 1800s, we didn't have the income tax. Trump obviously talked about maybe getting rid of the income tax, which I would, of course, appreciate very much. But the idea was we funded our whole country by tariffs. They weren't bad then. So why is it such a problem now? Can you kind of walk us through that experience of back in the day?
Sure. So there's two, I think, big differences between tariffs back then and tariffs today. The first is that we had a much, much smaller government. Now, look, I'm a libertarian. I would love to have a smaller government. But tariffs back then, if you were to try to do that today, you couldn't fund even a fraction of the government. You couldn't even fund the military because the tax base is so small that we just don't import enough goods to be able to slap a bunch of tariffs on stuff and get the revenue we need. Because, of course, if your tariffs get too high, then you don't get any imports and you don't get any revenue. So that's a huge difference. But the other one that I think is even more fundamental is that trade is a lot different today than it was in, say, 1875. The reality is that supply chains are now global. Manufacturers are now global. You know, about half of everything imported today stuff that American manufacturers use to make other stuff. So if you tax steel or aluminum or semiconductors or all these things, well, American manufacturers see their costs go up and they have two options. They can pass those costs on to American consumers or they can eat those costs. So they're kind of paying a corporate tax, an invisible corporate tax. The other big difference between then and now is that a lot of trade today is done between the same company. GM America imports from GM Canada, or Airbus in South Carolina imports from Airbus in France. Those supply chains, you really can't change overnight. Airbus can't go shop at the aircraft parts store over in Oklahoma. It has the supply chain. It has qualified suppliers and factories. So trying to readjust those multinational supply chains is far more painful today than it would be, say, in 1875 when we were trading rudimentary textiles and lumps of iron and that kind of stuff. It's just a totally different world.
Yeah, it's so complicated. And you do a really good job getting into the weeds in a lot of your writing, which I really appreciate it because I'm too dumb to really understand it. let me go, because I want to dive a little bit deeper on this idea of how complicated this is. A friend who works in the energy industry, and he manufactures parts that come in to help one of Trump's main goals, right, to become energy independent again and to produce more energy. He signs a long-term deal with a manufacturer to import those parts for an American company, and then gets a year into it, and the tariffs all change, and he's left with this choice to basically now lose money on the deal, the contract that he signed, yeah, because of these higher tariffs, or to try to go back to the well to renegotiate, which opens up bidding and complicates their entire company's future. And I feel like this is not a completely unique story. That sort of foundation that you're building a business on needs to be secure. And it's with this stuff changing all the time and all these adjustments, it's got to be impossible for the small business guy.
Yeah, businesses care a ton about predictability and consistency with policy. In fact, if you ask a lot of businesses, I think they'd say they'll take higher taxes or higher tariffs if you give them enough time to adjust so they can fix their contracts, they can make the investments you need and all that kind of stuff. So when you flip a tariff switch overnight, like we've done recently, and we did similarly in the first Trump administration, but actually still over a much longer period than today. But when you flip that switch so quickly, it really throws things into disarray. And the other thing it does is it gives investors pause about, well, is that switch that was so easily flipped on now going to be flipped off? And maybe I can't invest because, in a month or in 6 months, the president will have undertaken negotiations that cause these tariffs to go away. So this, I think, is actually a failure of our Congress more than anything. We've passed a bunch of laws that give the president broad authority to slap tariffs on stuff and remove tariffs without any congressional input, even though Congress has constitutional authority over trade. And that creates a lot of uncertainty in the market. And I think, in fact, right now, a lot of the market gyrations we're seeing are less about tariffs and more about uncertainty. As investors don't know what tomorrow will bring, instead of plowing ahead with their investments, instead of entering into new contracts or hiring more people, they just sit on their hands and wait. And that, is safe for them, but it's bad for the real economy.
I still don't follow how exactly this is constitutional. I mean, this is one of those things that specifically is in the Constitution that Congress handles this policy. I know we had a Supreme Court ruling at one point that kind of said within certain limits, they can delegate this authority. But I feel like, every president is way outside of those limits at this point. And, I don't know, when the Constitution gives the specific power to Congress, I don't think they should be able to just reassign it to somebody else. How is that even constitutional, Scott? Is there any chance of that being overturned?
Well, law geeks and some of my friends are eager to see if these laws do end up getting challenged. There are reasons for us not to be too confident that the courts are going to intervene here. The first is that trade coincides with presidential constitutional powers on foreign affairs and on national security. A lot of these laws relate to national security. And, courts are pretty hesitant to get into that area, even where you're talking about a constitutional authority like tariffs that's given to the Congress. So that's the first issue. The second issue is is that courts, even this court, have been reluctant to get into second guessing congressional delegations that do have some detail to them. And some of these laws are vague, and those are the ones that we might see challenged. But others have a lot of detail. And the president and the Trump administration or any other administration, like Biden did actually just about a year ago, as long as they check those administrative boxes, the courts are very likely going to be unwilling to intervene there too, because the courts, even this court, are okay with delegations of congressional powers as long as they meet certain circumstances. And I think, you know, in this case, in some cases, that's going to be a tough hurdle for any sort of challenger.
Okay, Scott, one last one for you. I was on Twitter earlier today when they were not in a major outage. And I got a message because I was talking on the radio show about my opposition to tariffs generally and my love of free trade. I get a lot of messages like this, and I was about to start replying to it. And then I was like, wait, I have Scott Linscombe on today. Let me give it to him and he can respond to it. So this is you got a little litany coming here. But listen to this, because I think this is pretty typical of the type of things that I hear from someone who is a conservative. He says, you always love to tell us how free trade, you love free trade and hate tariffs. All 43 of my years have been lived in the Rust Belt. Please hear my quick perspective on why you're wrong. Please tell me what it is about free trade that you love so much that outweighs the reality of what happened to us. It destroyed thousands of U.S. manufacturing jobs and communities and our self-reliance, mechanized communist China, kept our uniparty in office for decades, and exploited the people and environments of the third world. Plenty of us American companies pay Americans, and we all seem to make a fine living. The profits made in immoral ways hide behind a veil of free trade that never was. Wake up and quit living in the version of conservatism you read in a book. So he was a little fired up, Scott.
Yeah, but those for sure.
Those are pretty, I think, a good summary of the types of complaints I hear about free trade. What do you say to that?
Well, you have to start with the facts. I think we all want to acknowledge we want the same things. We want a vibrant American economy. We want thriving communities. We want to have stable families and businesses and jobs. So we start with the fact that we all want the same things. Where I come from mainly is from the literature, from the facts and the evidence. And look, this is not a new experiment with protectionism. We have decades and decades of tariff experiments and trade negotiations and the rest. And in general, tariffs have just simply not worked very well to bring back jobs, to boost domestic industry. So they just don't seem to do what we want them to do. The second big issue is that we do need to take off our blinkers and look at the good things in the U.S. economy, not all of which are related to trade and globalization, but some of them certainly are. We have a vibrant variety at our grocery stores, in our car dealerships, and anywhere else that we shop because of free trade. You know, back when I was a kid, we were eating canned vegetables and maybe getting avocados a couple times a year. And now they're just ubiquitous. And we enjoy that variety, lower prices and better living standards because of these things. At the same time, you know, the U.S. manufacturing sector is still the second largest in the world. We are the second largest exporter in the world. We're home to some of the largest multinational manufacturers and some of the largest companies in general in the world. They benefit from access to imports, to access to foreign markets for their exports, to access to investment and in the smartest people in the world. Now, it's not all great, and it's not all painless. But in general, you know, we've seen wages rising over the last 40 years, adjusted for inflation. We've seen a lot of good things in the economy, too. And when you combine that optimism with, again, the fact that tariffs haven't worked very well, the answer is to find policies that do work to help some people that have been hurt by whether it's globalization or automation or anything else. And those policies are less about picking winners and losers in the market and slapping taxes on steel or avocados or anything else. They're about, you know, low taxes, light touch regulation, all of those great things that I think conservatives agree on, and less about interfering in international trade and in interfering with individuals' ability to buy from and sell to whomever they want.
Scott Linsicum, great stuff. He's the vice president of general economics for Cato's Stifel Trade Policy Center. I know that's complicated stuff. I appreciate you taking the time to kind of lay it all out to us, though, Scott. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Cool, wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Hol dir dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer.
Hey, remember that TikTok ban? I kind of do, and I feel like it hasn't actually happened. Jim Garrity, covering this for National Review, points out it hasn't happened, which is not legal. There was a law passed by both houses, the Senate and the House. You had it signed by the President of the United States. This is back in the Biden era. It was supposed to come into effect. There was a delay by President Trump. That was not part of the law. There was a way to delay it if there was a pending deal, but it didn't hit those the checkboxes it needed to delay it for 75 days. It's been delayed. We're coming up on the end of that delay. There does not seem to be a purchase anywhere in sight. And we're just kind of like, huh? This is not how our system works. And of course, there's just no appetite by for anyone to actually do it. That's fine, but the way that needs to happen is that you pass a law doing the opposite. Pass a law saying, okay, we no longer want the ban to exist. That you can do. We can't just ignore the law. That is where we are right now, and it's something worth going forward with, because if you can do this newfound power, what else can you do? What can the Democrats do next time they're in office? I'm a little concerned about that. There is some really good news on the border, or at least I don't know how it's going to work out, but I think it's really funny. Bill Malugan reports this scoop. The Trump administration has repurposed the controversial Biden-era CBP-1 cell phone app into a self-deportation app called CBP Home. Launches today. DHS says that any migrants who had the prior CBP-1 app, will have auto update to this new app and DHS user data from prior CBP-1 registrations to track migrants for removal. New app allows illegal immigrants and migrants in the U.S. to register with CBP to self-deport. They fill out the information, including their countries of citizenship, and then they submit it to CBP. You may be asking yourself, why would an illegal alien want to self-deport? Well, Christine Noem gave a statement that basically says the CBP Home app gives aliens an option to leave now and self-deport so that they may still have the opportunity to return legally. Basically, they're saying, hey, if we find you and you don't do this, we're going to deport you and you have no chance of ever coming back in. If you go through this process, hey, we'd love to put you in the line and welcome you when you should be legally here. According to CBP data, roughly 50,000 migrants were entering the U.S. every month via this app during the Biden administration, totaling nearly 1 million by the end of his presidency. Trump determined got rid of the program basically right away. No big surprise there. And now they've hijacked the Biden app for this purpose, which I really love. This is, by the way, what it looks like. Now you see, like, are you a deporting traveler? That's a checkbox. Submit your intent to deport and give yourself a nice little photo so you can show how wonderful you are. It's kind of a deporting selfie where you're waving goodbye to the border. It's a lot of fun. So that is kind of an interesting twist in this story. We'll see how that plays out. And finally, another one I can't wait to see how it plays out. Angel Reese, the WNBA player, is sending an official threat to the WNBA. Now, she's saying basically they don't make enough money. They should make lots more money. And with the CBA, the bargaining agreement coming up, the collective bargaining agreement, the women coming in next year are probably going to make more than us, says Angel Reese. I got to get in the meetings because I'm hearing if y'all don't give us what we want, we sitting out, which is a wonderfully formed sentence that is incredibly close to what we would call English. I also will say, by the way, isn't it just perfect? Like, no one has cared about the WNBA in multiple decades.
They had like four people watching games before Caitlin Clark came in. Caitlin Clark comes in. All of a sudden, people care about the sport. Wouldn't it just be perfect for them to go on strike immediately afterward? That is so incredibly, gloriously self-defeating that I can't wait to watch it happen. Okay, so here's what happened. Somebody was eating those Flamin' Hot Cheetos, and I'm more of a cheesy Cheeto guy myself, but a lot of people really enjoy those things. And usually when you're eating them, you're just kind of jamming them out of the bag directly into your mouth until they stop being in the bag anymore, and then you know it's time to stop, right? Like, that's how Cheetos work. At least that's how it works for me. However, this guy, for some reason, actually looked at one of the Cheetos he was eating and noticed something very important about it. Now, let me show you the picture. You might say that this looks like a very oddly formed Cheeto. It does. However, it also looks like a Pokemon character named Charizard. Now, there's Charizard. They're calling this Cheeto Cheetozard because it kind of looks like Charizard. More importantly, it went on auction and he sold it for $88,000 a Cheeto. I guess I'm supposed to look at what I eat now.